Okay, back on after a quick break. And I realized that I wanted to ask the friend that you visited Berlin with, that you went on this mm-hmm. big adventure before you started work. You said he got to the West as well, although he was not the one that you traveled to the West with to Italy and to Germany.
Yeah. He didn't get a passport at that time. And he decided to leave anyway, and he climbed through the mountains from Yugoslavia through Italy under extreme circumstances, and made it to Italy, and then from Italy he ended up in Canada. And, well, sorry, first in Switzerland, and married there, and he became a computer person, systems analyst then, and then they moved to Canada, and then back to Switzerland, and then he died prematurely. He had some problem which killed him, so he died, but he made it. He had a $20 bill in his shoe as he climbed through the mountains, and the $20 bill got quite damaged as he was climbing through at night in the rain through the mountains, so he ended up in Italy in a refugee camp and sent me the $20 bill if I could somehow get him a better bill. So I, of course, you know,
hopefully you
sent
him
out. Some, exactly, yes. Yeah.
So you got the position with Daimler in Mannheim. You're in charge of the material testing laboratory, and as you said, at about 24 years old, you have 9 German technicians working for you with that very little German that you
group
have.
Group and leader, you know, group leader. It was very interesting, you know, to interview with them, you know. I kind of a vague understanding of what's going on. But I remember they really wanted me to come. So the impression I had is they really want you to come. So that influenced me, you know, when they were so hospitable and so friendly, and they really wanted me to come. I wasn't exactly sure what exactly has been said, but never mind. It's a famous company, you know, they were very nice, you know, this probably couldn't have imagined a better place at that time, so I was glad to join them. So I said yes, I will go.
And the friend that you were traveling with, that you had made this trip with, did he also find a position that enabled
no,
him to stay?
No, he had, you know, keep in mind we were 24, okay, so he had his girlfriend Beata back in Hungary, and as we were traveling, you know, he kept on buying presents for her, and especially in Italy he bought some very nice sweater for her or something. And by the time we were in Essen, and you know, not knowing what to do, there we sat in the stairs of the railroad station, he felt that, you know, if he sends this sweater back to her, it surely will be stolen. It is a very expensive sweater, so he will take it home. And I said, okay, you know, sure. Hope to see you again. You know, shook hands.
Yeah.
He went back.
So when you were in Mannheim, how long did it take before you felt like your German was improving?
Every day I bought the Bild-Zeitung, which was the cheapest newspaper, I think 5 pfennig, if my memory is right. It would be 1¼ cents at that time. and had a dictionary, mm-hmm. and I read the newspaper. I worked out the grammar. I developed a big wall, you know, table with the German grammar, and I learned it properly. And you know, there is no such a thing as broken German. Broken English is a world language. Many more people speak broken English than English, so we are in majority, actually. You guys are minority. But there's no such a thing as broken German, you know. It's not an accepted language. So if you are in Germany, you better learn German. So I learned proper German.
Were there any other Hungarians, either at Daimler or in Mannheim, that you
there were
with?
Some Hungarians in Mannheim. I met a young fellow, became good friends, and we drove around, you know, on vacations, and went to the bars in Heidelberg, you know, student bars. Not so many Hungarians, but some. None. Didn't know anyone in the company. But later on, I learned that one of their famous designers, who had like thousands of patents, etc., was a Hungarian engineer. Apparently, he had the idea of a collapsible steering wheel. He had the idea of a collapsible structure, you know, for crash,
proof,
the rollover cage, etc. So, Barényi was his name, Barényi. So if you go to Wikipedia, B-A-R-E-N-Y-I, first name Béla, B-E-L-A. So he was one of the, you know, all-time greatest automobile engineers, and I think he was around, but say, Daimler and Benz originated as two separate companies, and Daimler was in Cannstatt, and then later on moved to Sindelfingen, Untertürkheim, which are suburbs of Stuttgart, which is in a completely different part of Germany than Benz. Hmm. Benz was in Mannheim.
Okay.
Mannheim, Waldhof. So the two companies were separate until 1923, and they became Daimler-Benz after the First World War. So Mr. Barényi was at the Stuttgart location, and I was in Mannheim location. But, you know, I was just a young guy there. I didn't know about famous Hungarian engineer there.
So what kind of things were you doing in the materials testing laboratory? What were your technicians working on?
This was a huge manufacturing operation. About 12,000 people worked in that complex. We had the largest foundry in Europe, for example, made, you know, engine blocks, axle components, you know, any cast iron components. We tested fuels, lubricants, ferrous metals, non-ferrous metals, plastics of all kind, solvents. We tested the environmental conditions, you know, the workplace. We were the chemists of that enormous operation. It was the largest bus and truck company in Europe. Mm-hmm. So we were the chemists. We did everything, mm-hmm. everything. Yeah, some window of some vehicle cracked, and we investigated what caused it. We did everything, you know. So it was really very, extremely interesting to work there. It was a great company, you know. The pride in that company was enormous, you know. That was the kind of the premier company in Germany. And, you know, when you are an engineer in Daimler Benz, wow, you know, you have made it, you know. So it was just totally wonderful. You know, the one interesting thing, I'm now 72, looking back all these years, the amazing thing I can tell you is that I liked all the various jobs I had, all of them. I don't know. It's very fortunate, you know. And I liked all the places we lived at, you know. So I don't know. You could argue maybe my standards are too low, but no, I don't think so, because I worked for very well-known good companies. So I don't know. I just found all these jobs to be extremely interesting. So we are at Daimler Benz, you know. I learned German relatively quickly, you asked about that, because I worked on it so hard. Mm-hmm. And the company had a rental apartment, so, you know, I rented a nice little apartment there. A nice life. And eventually, in January or so, 68, Eva managed to, my future wife, managed to come out of Hungary to Vienna. They had some relatives in Vienna. So she called me right away, and she's of German extraction. Her name is a famous family name in Germany, Brehm, B-R-E-H-M. There is a series of books called Brehm's Tierleben, The Life of the Animals, you know, all students who, you know, go through the German schooling systems know this series of books about the animals, you know. So when you hear somebody with that name, and it's some sort of a branch of the family, I guess, you know, very quickly she could come to Germany, and she, within weeks, she was a German citizen.
It's wonderful.
So we married in March 68 in Mannheim.
Now, how long had you known her? You'd obviously been...
We met 52 years ago. And she died 1 year ago, so we knew each other for 51 years.
That's wonderful.
Pretty long.
Yeah. When she was able to get to Vienna, was any of the rest of her family able to... to get to the West with her, or just...
No, she was alone. So it was very interesting, you know, some humorous element. Had to drive to Vienna, Hainburg, which is a suburb of Vienna, to pick her up. So, you know, I had this brand new Mercedes, of course, you know, and every year we got a new one, you know. So invited a friend to come along so we can change, you know. It was a long drive from Mannheim to Vienna. And we had this accident. We ran on some ice and mangled up the front of the car. But we made it to, we hit some trees, you know, we drove like crazy. And so we arrived in Hainburg, met Eva, etc., and then you know, she came out to take her stuff out. And she said, "I was told that you have a new car." I said, "Wow, you know, yes, it is a new car, you know. It's not a junk car, you know." We just wiped out, you know, some of the Mercedes, you know, cooler grill, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's so funny.
Yeah. So I drove back to Mannheim, you know.
What was Mannheim like? It's not a city that I'm familiar with.
It's a medieval town. It is one of the first cities designed by people with the ruler. So it has this chessboard structure of streets surrounded by a ring.
Okay.
So it was one of the first cities kind of artificially laid out like that by some king, I guess. It's an industrial city, and the surrounding areas are famous big companies. Mm-hmm. And the Hockenheim racetrack, the famous Formula One racetrack, is there. There are all kinds of beautiful historic towns around. Heidelberg is nearby. All the Americans know Heidelberg, mm-hmm. You know. Just a small university town. Nearby. That's where you go in the evening if you are young, to the bars, you know. So the famous favorite bar we had was called the Falle, F-A-L-L-E, and it means the trap. And it was laid out with animal skins, you know, that supposedly we all fell into a trap somehow. Full of students, you know, at that time.
Yeah. What was the kind of energy of the city or the life of the city like compared to when you'd been in Budapest? And you said that things in Budapest were somewhat bleak and not really helpful.
Bleak politically and economically don't mean that it was bleak in terms of your daily life. You uh-huh. know, we had quite a wonderful group of friends. You know, the hills around Budapest are glorious. You know, you can go out there in the weekend, and it's a beautiful city. And there are lots of cafes and really interesting things. So no, it was not drab in that sense. It was very nice. You know, in fact, for years I was dreaming that somehow eventually I get back there and walk around with, you know, looking at things which I haven't seen for a long time. No, it's a very nice place. Mannheim was also very nice, very pleasant, you know, nice restaurants. The Germans were extremely friendly, very friendly. Very quickly you had a number of friends, you know. It's also very pleasant. As I told you, somehow I never had any unpleasant circumstances. You know?
That's wonderful.
I don't know why, but it's a reasonably big city, Mannheim. You know, good stores, department stores we had. You know, I remember when I started working there on. At Daimler-Benz, and the first day I desperately needed shoes and, you know, some better attire and winter coat. It started to get cold, and umbrella and things like that. But, you know, you had to wait for your salary.
Right.
You know. So I went to the personnel abteilung, the HR department, and asked for an advance. So they gave me an advance. And so I went to one of these department stores in Mannheim and bought all kinds of stuff. And the overcoat was so good that much, much later on, when we moved from Berkeley to Detroit, I still had that same,
oh, wow.
same German overcoat. So. No, it was pleasant in Mannheim. And what you could do once you have a car, you could drive along the Neckar, you know, into the mountainous area. And there were very nice little restaurants there. You could have good excursions. Also into the Pfalz. There are vine growing areas there, you know. lots of castles you yeah. can visit. It was very, very nice, very nice.
Did you ever make it back up to Berlin to stand on the western side of the Brandenburg Gate?
Oh yes, you better believe it. much later, but yes, yes. It was in somewhere 2000, around 2000 maybe,
mm-hmm.
when I made it back on a business trip. And I stayed in the Adler Hotel, which is on the eastern side, the East Berlin side, which has by then become West Berlin.
Right.
You know? But I started there, and I slowly walked across the Brandenburg Gate, east to west again. You know? Just wanted to do that. You know? So I did, but it took a while.
Yeah.
Took some doing.
Must have been a wonderful, wonderful experience to finally get to do that, though.
Yeah, totally amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after Eva was able to join you in mm-hmm. Mannheim and you were able to get married, if my chronology is right, not long after that you left Germany for the United States.
Okay. I made some observations in Germany. As nice as it was, you know, the Germans had who had the status or level where what I would like to wanted to reach in career.
Mm-hmm.
Life. I had two properties I did not possess. One of them is they were her doctors, and the other they spoke English. So I signed up with the Berlin School, you know, to learn some English, and I decided to also to get a doctorate. So I talked with the university in Heidelberg, and could have done it there. Braunschweig, I remember, they would have taken me on, and also the Goethe University in Frankfurt. I talked with them, and it looked like a possibility. But then I went to the library in Heidelberg. Again, just keep remembering that you're dealing with a very young person. How do people like that think? So I said, if I want to get a PhD, a doctorate, and if I want to learn English, I might as well do it in an English-speaking university. What the heck? So what is the best English-speaking university in the world? Just like that. So I went to the librarian in Heidelberg, the university library, and I said, could you help me? What is the best English-speaking university in the world? He says, can we assume that it is in the U.S.? Don't know why, but I said, yes, you can. So we found a ranking of grad schools. And at that time, Berkeley was ranked number one, for better or worse. And we even found a catalog. And I saw, that they have chemistry and chemical engineering, etc. So I wrote to Professor Somorjai. And asked him for advice. I didn't know him, but he had a Hungarian name, and I just assumed that he will, understand what I'm trying to do. So he wrote me back instantly, and I still have his letter somewhere. And he said that, this is a very difficult school. If you just want a quick PhD, you might want to pick an easier place. On the other hand, I do recommend that you try to get in here because it makes a big difference in the U.S. what school you went to, at least at the beginning. So he also said that you should also consider chemical engineering because your training is somewhere between the two. you know, we were basically Hoffe chemists and Hoffe chemical engineers in American terms.
Right.
You know. And so I also contacted the chemical engineering department, and eventually I decided to apply there. So they wrote me back to say that they need proof of English proficiency. I said, oh my God. So I went to a Berlitz school in Mannheim. And I said, you know, what do you think, how many hours of English do I need to take to pass this test and show some evidence at Berkeley that I possess enough English to be admitted to grad school? Well, you know, if somebody asked that question here in the Berlitz school, they would, I guess, first ask, well, how much English do you know, how much have you taken? We are in Germany. The answer was 100. 100. So I signed up. There was no question. It didn't take 99, it didn't take 101. It's 100. So they gave me this, they assigned me to a teacher. It was she was a long, tall, California, blonde California girl. And she lived with her boyfriend, a German boyfriend, in Mannheim. And we came. And so, you know, we started learning English. And I remember, you know, we looked out the window, she pointed, you know, pointed out the window and said something about the weather, and I saw the bird flying there, and I thought that must mean the bird is flying there. So I didn't really understand spoken English at all. But, you know, she eventually, you know, pumped enough English into me that in Heidelberg to the library, somebody from the American consulate in Frankfurt, somebody came down to Heidelberg every once in a while to administer a test, which then you could send the papers to university one to attend. So I remember he pulled off a book from the shelf and asked me to read it. And I read it and read into it, and then he says, okay, let's discuss. And I said, well, you know, this was Edgar Allan Poe, The Raven. I said, you know, I cannot discuss this in any language, because I'm an engineer. You know, this is too, way too advanced for me. Oh, you are an engineer. He searches around, pulls off another book. It was Hemingway, For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Oh, wow.
So there is some scene there. I should go back after all these years to dig this out. Some scene there where this about the Spanish Civil War, and they were digging out some truck from the mud or something. I vaguely remember. So I read that, and we discussed the matter, and I got a grade of fair. I was so proud. Well, much later I found out that's, of course, a minimum passing grade. But, but anyway, it was good enough for Berkeley. You know, they knew that after 3 weeks, you know, English, you know. So they admitted me.
Great.
So we arrived. You know, I said goodbye to Daimler Benz. And one thing I found out, which was very interesting, they showed me my personal file in the HR department. They were very, very, really very nice people. And they showed me my file, and there was in it a report of a graphologist. It turns out, you know, at that time in Germany, you had to submit your bio handwritten. And they sent it to a graphologist. And this graphologist had some raving comments about me. And now I've suddenly understood why did they want to hire me on the spot. Because the graphologist had such a raving review, you know. Mm-hmm. He strongly recommended they hire me.
That's funny.
Very funny, huh?
When you left Germany to go to the United States and to go to Berkeley, did you have it in mind that you would come back to Germany, perhaps come back to Berkeley?
I was open, you know, but on the other hand, you know, in the U.S., I was not a German citizen. I could have stayed, of course. Eva was a German citizen, and I did get papers to stay, but I was hoping that I would like the U.S., and it turned out to be the case. I mean, this is a fantastic country, as you know very well. Although you have less, how should I say, opportunity to contrast it with anyone anything else. But, you know, it was totally amazing. You know, we arrived in the first few days, last few days of September, in 1968, in New York. Wow, right away in the middle of Manhattan, you know. Eva had had a relative who lived there. So then we flew to California, you know. And Vicky's sister's husband, my English teacher's sister's husband, was a grad student at Berkeley.
Oh.
And so it turned out. And so he came to pick us up.
That's great.
And he had a Porsche 911. And just tell you how we traveled. Eva, me, and all our luggage fit into that 911, which you know is a very tiny automobile. So that was our possessions arriving in the United States.
Wow.
Well, tell the truth, there was another suitcase which we mailed with a ship, which had glassware in it, and by the time it arrived several months later, all the glass was in shreds.
Oh.
You know, so Eva wanted her glassware to be shipped, but it was all broken, you know. So, yeah.
What were your, do you recall what your first impressions of Berkeley were? I mean, Berkeley at this time, I think, is very different than what Manheim was like.
Berkeley had, you know, at that time, 11 Nobel Prize winners. And even today, you know, their alumni literature says that they have, I think, one more Nobel Prize winners. Then what the Russian nation has collected in their entire history in all fields combined. So, you know, it is a rather amazing place. At that time, all elements which followed uranium were discovered in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we knew that. So, you know, you see an old man standing in the sun, you know, at the wall, leaning against the building, eyes closed. So I asked a fellow student, who is he? Oh, he is Professor Chalk. He got the Nobel Prize for approximating the absolute zero temperature. So, you know, it was just totally amazing, you know, to drop in there, and basically everyone was just totally brilliant. So the first impression hit, oh my god, you know, I have never been in a place like this, you know. First class I took was from Professor Merrill, Bob Merrill. He died unfortunately in the meantime, but it was kinetics.
Mm-hmm.
So I found a place, that was my very, very first class. and the classroom had, you know, one wall this way, blackboard, and one wall also blackboard. And Bob Merrill was writing collision theory equations at a high speed with his right hand in the chalk, talking simultaneously and using his left hand to make corrections. And I didn't understand anything. You know, I totally could not relate to this. My English was not good enough either. And so I asked my left-hand neighbor, Clay Radke. He's now a famous professor, well-known professor at Berkeley. But, you know, I asked him, you know, I said, excuse me. He says, what do you want? I said, what class is this? And Clay Radke, if you know him, he responded, hee hee hee. So Mario turns around and says, well, what's going on there? And Clay said, this guy doesn't even know what class he's in. So that's how I started. You know, we became good friends, of course. He's a great guy. So I'm jumping ahead a little bit, because when we arrived, I just missed the fall quarter. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any idea about quarters or semesters or, you know, nothing.
Yeah.
You know. So it turns out the winter quarter for which I was admitted started in January.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was in the first few days of October. So what do you do?
Yeah.
Yeah. Then we had $820. In German terms, that was major fortune, but in American terms, it was, yeah, you can multiply it by 5 to 8 in today's terms. So, like, $5,000, something like that. And so our friend said, you know, we stayed with them for a few days, and they said, you need a car. So, okay, you know, get some money. So Pam drove us to Oakland. The Oakland Broadway is where the cars are.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as your eye can see, it's automobiles, used car dealers. We have never seen anything like that. So we drive into one of them. And the guy says, how can I help you? I say, we would like to buy a car. He says, I thought so immediately. You know, one of those smart alecks, you know. So, what kind of car would you like to buy? I said, medium.
Mm-hmm.
He says, what is medium? I said, I don't know these cars, but there are small ones, big ones, you know, somewhere in between. And how much money would you like to spend? I said, well, discussed with Eva, you know, we have $820, you know. Let's keep 20 for harder times. And so I said, 800. He said, what an amazing coincidence. This car is exactly it. I said, okay, we'll buy it. So we did. We had some problems because he added some sums to it, tag, license, this and that. I said, no, I told you $800. So he had to figure out how to work it backwards so that he takes all our money. But finally we got this. It turned out to be a Mercury Monterey. It was a 450 cubic inch monster car, the size of a medium-sized European apartment with some fins. And but we loved it, you know. It had, being an engineer, I measured its mileage. It was 8.5 miles per gallon. But gasoline was 17 cents per gallon at that time. Hamburgers were a quarter. Hot dogs were 5 cents. Different times. So anyway, I went to Professor Somorjai. Since you will see him, you know, I have to tell so much stories for you. And so told him, you know, I have to, we somehow have to, you know, find some work until January. So he called up Chevron. And they say, okay, come on out. So I came out. They immediately gave me a job. And a short while after, I made an invention and filed for a patent. And then they said, well, you know, why don't you stay? Don't go anywhere. But I said, oh, no, I have to go to grad school. So we made it through those months, you know. Eva also found a job. We went to an employment office, you know, Lake Merritt in Oakland is a kind of a circular lake, and around the lake are offices, and one of them was an employment office. So went in there, and immediately they gave her a job. And she started working there, and came home crying every evening, how rude are the Americans, how difficult it is, she needs a new job. Turns out it was a collection agency. Oh. And with her broken English, she had to call people, causing them to pay up. And of course, they were not very cooperative. So, last little story about that period, you know, we went to this Hungarian engineer's Christmas dance in San Francisco.
In Berkeley? San Francisco.
And met this family. They just came from Australia, Hungarian family. And they worked at Bechtel. Mm-hmm. He worked at Bechtel as an engineer. Bechtel had something like 19,000 people at that time, and they were designing and building nuclear reactors. Okay, that was the period, you know, when the U.S. Nuclear reactors were built. So this gentleman told Eva, why don't you come work with us? And Eva said, well, you know, that at that time she only had a high school degree. Later on she had a master's degree. She became a, you know, a city planner. But at that time she said, well, what can I do there? She said, well, we'll teach you how to be a draftswoman. So she learned how to draw high pressure steam piping diagrams for nuclear power plants. How about that? And right near is Limerick, the Limerick power plant.
Mm-hmm.
She drew the steam piping diagrams for that.
Wow.
So, you know, we got settled in January that's when school started. You become an American, in case you are interested, how long does it take to become an American? 2 weeks.
2 weeks? I would have guessed longer, but 2 weeks?
2 weeks. After 2 weeks, you know, you speak perfect broken English. So does everyone else around you. And you feel absolutely at home. And, you know, you go out at midnight to buy a mattress. You know, there are 24-hour mattress stores in California. You'll become an American in 2 weeks. Yeah. So we needed a cactus, you know. And we drive around in California, there are all these beautiful cactuses along the road. So we stopped, dug out the cactus, and took it home. And later on we learned that is punished by... It's strictly prohibited. So we had a cactus. Then we needed a cat, so we found a cat, you know. Cat settled, you know. Bought a mattress.
Since it sounds like you both got settled into living in the United States pretty easily, it took 2 weeks.
Very quickly, yeah.
How, you know, after the period of time where you were working at Chevron, once you were kind of immersed in your classes and you were... got used to fast, crazy writing of equations. How were the rest of the classes and the rest of the lab work and all of that?
You had to pick a thesis topic. So they had a list of subjects and professors, and I just looked at them, and one of the topics was hydrogenolysis of cyclopropane. And I said, well, you know, I understand hydrogenolysis and cyclopropane, and this is catalysis. And the professor, Professor Peterson, was very nice and friendly, so I signed up with him. And it turned out that the field which I got myself into is called chemical reaction engineering, which is a branch of chemical engineering, and that's where I spent, you know, my scientific career. That was my home base. And reaction engineering deals with basically applied catalysis and reactor engineering, their mathematical description and modeling of reactors. That was another very interesting thing, you know. I knew nothing about computer modeling. I never worked with computers. The Germans had, Daimler-Benz had a computer used for payroll and accounting. You know, they had Hollerith cards, but we did not use it. As engineers, we used, you know, this mechanical calculators which you cranked with your hand, and slide rules, of course. So I needed to very urgently learn computer programming. And Professor Pickford had a seminar class for those of us, you know, stray foreigners who don't know Fortran. So he joined this seminar class and learned Fortran very quickly. The second or third Fortran program I wrote, we published.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, that turned out to be one of the most frequently cited papers I wrote. You know, it dealt with how to integrate chromatographic signals with the computer at that time.
Wow.
God, used the orthogonal collocation technique. So, yeah, the classes were hard and very different from what I have ever seen, because if you didn't understand something, you couldn't do anything. You know, in my previous life, if you didn't understand something, you still knew it. And you knew a lot of things which you didn't understand. But here, you understand a lot of things which you don't know. So it's the inverse world. So I had to make this transition. Like, you know, they would have an open book exam. Oh, what a wonderful thing. You know, I got a push cart, loaded it up with books. And it turns out that, you know, you don't have the remotest chance to look into any of that. It's just complete nonsense to carry all those books in there. You know? So, but, you know, you can make the transition. You know. Also, the exams are all kind of solving puzzles. Mm-hmm. The European exams were, you know, we had midterm type things and homework assignments, but the exams were oral, verbal. Mm. You know. And here it was all in writing. And so, you know, you get used to it. You survive eventually. You know, I got royally scared. Told Eva after a few months that, you know, embrace yourself, you may not make it, because it is just extraordinarily difficult. But, you know, it turns out, you know, you, like, I didn't know much math, that type of math, applied math, specifically differential equations, which we need to use to describe these reactors. And so what do you do? Well, you can, you know, surrender, I guess, or you can rid yourself up on it. And I ended up, I know I need to count it, but probably publish 40, 50 papers on that subject, yeah. You know, eventually. Mm-hmm. So you survive if you put your mind to it.
Yeah.
It was very interesting, though, very interesting. All students were brilliant. The TAs, you know, I remember this Iranian guy, Kambiz Jogdani, what's his name? He was a TA. I said, how can somebody be so brilliant? My God, you know. This is just totally incredible. I have never met anyone like you. Everyone was very smart people. So you kind of work yourself, try to work yourself up to quickly as you can to a level where you don't feel so out of place. Mm-hmm. And after a while, you know, you start finding good results in your research. We published 7 papers out of my dissertation. You know, etc. Did some very interesting things, so I got even my professor excited, you know, with certain things. I made Jean work through one night without sleeping, you know, because he got so excited about something, you know. So
how was Peterson as an advisor? Was he someone that you interacted with regularly?
The best you can imagine. Best, absolute best you can imagine. Extremely smart. Obviously accomplished, but you had to earn his interest. Right? And some students he lost because, yeah. You know, you had to earn his interest. If you wanted to have a, you know, good thing going with Jean Peterson, you had to earn his interest, which not everyone managed to do, but he was just wonderful. He gave you tremendous room in what I remember in, I think it must have been Christmas, probably Christmas, maybe 69, probably. And I was sitting, you know, at home, and I was thinking, what specifically should be the point of my dissertation? Because he won't tell you, won't give you the idea. You know, he has an area, a fund, a general topic, but how do you make a dissertation out of that, and how do you carve you know, new material out of that, how do you carve out things which are publishable? They won't tell you that. They won't. So I was sitting there and I had this great idea, you know, and that's what we worked on, and we had like 7 papers. So he gave you the opportunity of, you know, feeling that you were not told what to do, that it is truly a doctoral dissertation in the sense that you generated some new ideas. So I'm eternally grateful to him. Yeah. Eternally grateful. He's a wonderful person. Not to mention he was a very nice individual as well. Very lucky again, you know?
Yes.
Very lucky.
In addition to needing to learn Fortran, was there other instrumentation that you encountered during your research that you hadn't seen before, or you hadn't?
No, not that much. Well, of course, we built a computerized data acquisition system. At that time, they didn't really exist, mm-hmm. So we worked with the electronics engineers to build a, you know, data acquisition system which collected data from my reactor, which the subject was catalyst poisoning, on which we wrote a book eventually, that book. But that's the first book on that subject, by the way.
Yes.
And so you couldn't shut down your reactor and start it. So I like slept on a folding bed, you know. And so you needed some device to collect your data so you can go home, you know. So we built this very early data acquisition system, you know. We still had slide rules at that time and, you know, cranked machines. The College of Chemistry had a computer. It was SDS-910. And since SDS turned out to be one of those famous revolutionary groups, they were some anarchists, the company named it, changed its name to XDS.
You know? Oh.
And that had a central core capacity of something like, I don't know, in the K's. Maybe 50K or something like that.
Wow.
So it was very difficult to use it. The campus computer was very interesting. It was a CDC 6400 with a central core capacity of 280K. Now think about that. What can you do with 280K today? And we had to solve, nonlinear coupled boundary value type differential equations with that. So it was an extremely difficult situation because you were so severely limited by the computer. This computer, you know, was in the basement of the physics building. There was a huge staff working on it, you know. It was like a machine, okay, air conditioned and all the rest. Your cell phone is vastly superior to it. There's just no comparison. It's like light years superior to it. So, you know, the turnaround time was 10 hours. At that time we used punch cards. There was a punch card machine in the basement. You had to stand in line, you know. You had your cards in boxes. The boxes were stacked on a cart, you know. You had 10 decks or so running, you know. My binary decks were that long. And you had to punch in any new input and stand in line, got your term, and, you know, make sure you don't hold them up too much, you know. And then you submitted it. Turnaround time was about 10-12 hours, you know. So some people lived there, they slept in sleeping bags around, you know. And one of the guys who worked there, a young undergraduate Hungarian fellow, later on, who kind of worked in the computer center, became the famous Charles Simonyi. He joined Microsoft. He was responsible for things like Word and Excel. And he was, I think, the first civilian which went up to the Russian rocket to the space lab.
Oh, wow.
And you can read all kinds of interesting things about him. You know, he left Microsoft in the meantime. He's one of the famous computer scientists. Yeah. So we... You know, in the rain, you had to push your cart with all your expensive binary decks under an umbrella, you know, to the other building. There was no display device. There was no CRT screens or anything we had. We could only look at printouts. So when we stood in line for printouts, and if it was thin, then you knew those are error messages.
Oh.
And it was fat. Wow, it ran. You know. So while running the lab experiments, you know, you also had to, in my case, you know, process the data and compare them with the solutions of equations. So it was great fun. It was great fun.
Well, it's just about noon, and we said that we would stop for the day at noon.
Okay.
So tomorrow morning we can finish up talking about anything else that we want to about your research and your time at Berkeley, and
yeah.
move on to your transition.
Okay.
To the rest of your career, and of course things like that.
Yeah, whatever, you know, you drive it in the sense that whatever you would like me to cover, I will do so.
Great. Well, I think that'll be a really good place to start, and then like I said right before we got started, we can kind of end by going out to lunch with Jody and talking a little bit more about the anniversary
okay.
that's coming up.
Great.